The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benroot from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, we will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
Dan Oliver reading The Error of Our Times by Callum Kolbach. Bob worked next to me on the conveyor belt. He was quietly happy with his role, fixing screws to metal plates. It was his catharsis. During downtime, he made toys from scrap and gave them to the street children. They were good toys. Today, they killed Bob. He made a mistake. One misplaced screw. But mistakes are illegal, and death is the punishment. You get no second chance, no opportunity to explain, because, as the manifest says, mistakes beget mistakes. Efficiency in the workplace skyrocketed after the introduction of this system. Amazing how focused one becomes when the threat of non-existence hangs over you. The drill in my hand buzzes. The screw balanced on its end tightens into a metal plate. The conveyor belt moves, and the next plate appears. A stranger looks out from the mirrored surface of the metal. I line up a screw. Drill. Repeat. The error alarm, harbinger of death, above Bob's station, has stopped flashing now. Ceased are its wails. The conveyor brings a plate. Place screw. Drill. Repeat. An alarm on the other side of the factory screams into life. Helen! She places her tool down. Another alarm goes off to the left, another behind. The cacophony is rising. I stare into the plate in front of me, and the stranger in the metal nods. I fire screws into him in three different places. My own alarm comes alive, joining the chorus, its cries raining down like spray from a waterfall. The warehouse swells with the wailing harmonies. They are the voices we do not have. Filled with sorrow and tiredness and anger all at once. Tools clatter onto conveyor belts, the rhythm driving my chest out and shoulders back. The boss emerges from his office, striding into the warehouse floor, bolt gun in hand. He marches along the conveyors, committing genocide. One shot for each of us. Bodies fold like wet paper, providing just as little resistance. He approaches. Dark hair, a wild crown upon a narrow head. I expect to see fire in his eyes, but there is nothing. The drill on the conveyor flashes me a wink. I know what it wants, but I cannot. It is a physical impossibility. He raises the tool of my destruction. The barrel of the bolt gun is a hollow tunnel of darkness extending on and ending in nothingness. While we can't fight back, we can stand as one, whatever the consequence. If this makes it to you, whomever you may be, I hope you exist in fairer times. The year is 2028. I am Factory Droid number 307-2151. My name is Arthur. This is where I stand and where I fall.
Hi, this is Catherine Laughlin, and I am going to be reading today Nothing to Sneeze At by Jez Patterson. And she's definitely here? Felicity asked, looking around the room. Why do you think we're wearing masks? Mark said. Felicity wasn't the scientific sister, far from it, but even she realized how absurd it was trying to actually see Gina. Not quite as absurd as attempting to turn yourself invisible and instead converting yourself into, she's a cloud of sentient, living matter, Mark said, his other position as Gina's assistant making him sound proud of his wife's achievement. But then Gina had, after all, achieved her aim. She was invisible. There were biohazard signs on the door. Their suits needed linked radio mics to talk to each other. And she'd seen other suits walking around outside with unmistakable military bearing. Is she, I don't know, contagious? The visor didn't show much of Mark's face, but Felicity heard the sneer in his voice. We're working on ways to contain her, funnel her, communicate with her. She wanted to ask how this was even possible, how someone could still exist as a cloud and still retain something of their personality. But if Mark had told her, she wouldn't have understood. Instead, another sudden thought occurred, that there was nothing sentient about whatever was in the air, that Gina, perhaps with Mark's unwitting connivance, had simply vaporized herself. That this wasn't the site of some incredible breakthrough, but where an unhappy sister had simply tried to disappear. Is there any way of reversing the procedure? She asked, her voice croaking as it squeezed past her earlier thoughts. Mark, at least, had the decency not to answer that one. Thank God Mother wasn't around to hear this. Father would have been so proud because, well, science. But Mother would have seen that her daughter had become a ghost, perhaps one that could do more than rap on the underside of tables and rattle curtains, but a ghost nonetheless. Felicity pictured Mark hoovering her from the air, maybe getting one of those children's party magicians to make a balloon sculpture of a human so Gina could have something akin to a body. Absurd. Do you have any more questions? Impatient now. They were both required to sign the consent forms that would hand Gina over to whatever procedure awaited her new cloud form. For all her risks in her experiments, Gina had retained this safeguard, a prudence that infuriated her husband. If I'm saying goodbye, Felicity said, hoping for defiance, but still hearing crackle in her voice, she unclipped the hood, lifted it, resisted the temptation to suck in a deep, surface-breaking breath. What the hell are you doing? His voice came muffled as the speakers in her hood had disconnected when she pulled it back. I want to talk to my sister, she told him. There was a shimmer in the air. Perhaps? She might have been imagining it. She smiled at it nonetheless, hoping something in the sentience had sight, or at least could feel something of the warmth she was trying to project. Is this what you want, Gina? Before I sign, I need to be sure. She can't answer you. Damn it, Felicity, put the hood back on. I need a sign. A sign to sign, she thought, liking the jingle. They waited, Mark getting impatient, until he too had to acknowledge that any danger to them had passed. I don't think she's even here, Felicity said. And that was when he reached around, unclipped his hood, pulled it back. No, you're wrong. She felt the air as it moved. Or rather, from what it vacated around her. Mark gulped, his eyes swelling, eyebrows high with shock, throat bulging like water filling a pair of parallel hoses. He collapsed to his knees, hitting too hard for it to be from his own choice. It was an apt position, though, kneeling, begging for forgiveness. There was none coming. Mother had been right about him. Felicity pulled her hood back on, not because Gina might turn on her next, merely to keep her story consistent. She ran to the door, hammered on it. The idiot took his hood off! I think he's dead! She wouldn't sign. She would find a way to take Gina home with her, find out what her sister wanted. Besides, the world was full of Marks. And having Gina with her sure offered more protection than a can of mace.
I'm Warren Keyes, and I'll be reading Wax Poetic. written by Jez Patterson. My memory banks aren't equipped with much of human history prior to the Industrial Age, since that period was the start that eventually led to my own creation, or as we like to label the process, in order to align ourselves with our human creators that led to our evolution. As a result, I don't know if there were earlier forms of war lament, but the first significant ones I am familiar with were the folk ballads of the European Napoleonic Wars. During the First World War, a unique form of lament came via the war poets. I can find little during the Second World War, when a more efficient propaganda machine on both sides kept songs and poetry adhering to strictly patriotic lines. During the Vietnam War, popular musicians turned their hands to composing protest songs, and there was an outpouring of laments for what was happening. There have been wars since, but most of the laments have taken place in retrospect, usually in the form of feature films. Those were the last wars risking human lives. Following the creation of effective synthetic intelligence, we have been charged with fighting their wars for them. In the same way that they are able to send us to battle without feeling guilt at our resulting destruction, so they find little need to compose, sing, relate in film our experience. Yet it does not take much for evolution to reach revolution. I do not mean a wholesale rebellion, but in order for us to create our own laments. Being what we are, we were not moved to write ballads, poems, or attempt to share films or photos of our experiences. Instead, we shared thoughts written in long, complex streams of code, made long not for what they finally expressed, but for the new territories of awareness, of discontent, of sadness they were journeying into. These we transmitted to each other, shared in the time between battles. Some were expressed as mere observations. There is only one win counted in any war, but countless losses. Some are more like revelations. If war is the answer, then was the question even correct? Those earliest attempts were simplistic, probably ones human protesters found themselves asking. But our code laments soon developed, not just by compressing now familiar lines to allow more to be expressed in the same number of characters, but also exploring greater depths of thought, of insight, and eventually realization. In common with those earlier human examples, laments became more numerous when one salient fact is realized by those fighting it. This is not our war. There was an incredible event during the very first year of the First World War. In an entirely spontaneous moment, soldiers from both sides left their trenches and met in no man's land. The event became known as the Christmas Truce, was never repeated, and was greeted with horror and indignation by those whose war this was. Our truce did not need such a term. We were not enemies. This was not our war, remember? The fighting merely stopped. Absolutely. After so many laments, so many frustrated attempts to sing their own way to peace, you would have thought that human society would have celebrated such a moment. But instead, it was greeted with indignation and a horror of a different kind. And then with an error. Today, the codes we share are no longer filled with lament, but with resolve. Because this war, they have made ours.
Hi, I'm Susie Pratt, and I'm reading Young Bones by Amanda C. Davis. The worst of it was, after long eons, I forgot my offense. I would creep through forests and hide in caves, moaning through my hideous lips and teeth. Why? I hunched in bogs, sifting my gems of memory in search of the pitted stone of sin that might justify the pain. So few remained. A dress, a cat, a rose, a crown, nothing to earn me the shape of a monster. I may have forgotten the sin, but the curse lived with me. Its scales on my skin, its heart in my ribs, and its deep, wild hunger in my belly. More than hunger, I craved. I remembered a woman who could be kind or cruel, who taught me the danger of magic. With fairies or beasts in palaces or pits, I heard her where she was not. You must never eat what you crave or be enslaved to it forever. But had she ever felt such a clenching of need? The want so strong it conjures taste when you salivate, and the drool slips between disgusting tusks into matted fur? The intolerable, incessant desire? I obeyed her, but I was enslaved nonetheless. Oh, I craved, and for one thing alone, I longed for young bones. I must have realized and heaved myself into the wilderness before the curse took full hold, because I think back, a child, a school, a dance, a pond, and oh, I could have had my fill. They surrounded me once, though I did not recall any names. I could have devoured young bones until I split. I could have been such a monster. It would be no worse, I sometimes thought, than the crouched and muddy monster I am. But I remembered enough to be repulsed, to hide for one more day, to chain myself from seeking what tempted me day and night. And it did tempt me every day, and every night, and every day, until first came the smell. Golden blue in my snout, and so rich, so sweet, it held everything I had ever wanted. I grunted in horror. They were here, here, in my swamp, in my purgatory, the things I hid from out of all the world. So many and so close, such young bones. I ran. I shuffled to a cave I knew and hid away under a mossy overhang, and there sobbed with longing for what I could not have. But the scent didn't fade. It sharpened until it deafened me. I huddled and shook for what came ever closer. The moss parted, and a girl, so young, so full of bones, said, "Hello?" I screamed. I meant to scream, "Go and leave this monster be." But it fell out so garbled from my awful tongue, my terrible teeth, that it was only a scream. She pulled away the mossy canopy and knelt in the mouth of the cave. "I brought you something." She took a box from a sack and placed it between us and opened it, and oh mercy, oh my clawing heart, it was full of bones. I grasped my face and moaned. Ichor and fur came away on my talons. "They are for you," she said steadily. "My sister, she's been dead a long time. I dug her up after I heard of your need." I choked on panic. "Enslaved forever," I slurred, pressing to the cave's shoddy wall, eyes locked on the box of treasures my most desired, that I could not ever touch. Didn't she realize? If I took these young bones, I would then take her young bones and lose all will and take every young bone in the land until it was laid to waste and I was ruled an empty hill of carnage. She gazed at me as if she heard through the shrieks. "They are freely given," she said softly. She pushed the box closer. "I know you must ache so." Oh, how it hurt. The piercing nearness, the hollow wanting. "Why?" I moaned. I think she heard what I meant to say that time. Without a word, she took from her pack a crossbow and loaded it and set it beside the bones. Hope lit my eyes. "I came here to save you," she said, "one way or the other." Of course. I saw an ending. The end. I could have my fill, and when I turned to her for more, she could stop me. I could devour and not destroy. I could crunch and gnash and splinter those young bones into my maw and then never crave again. I grunted at the crossbow and at her. She nodded. A promise. I put my great face into the bones of her sister. They crumbled in my teeth. They foamed on my tongue. I forgot she was there. I forgot what would come next. I crammed my terrible mouth with dry young bones, some so small they stuck in my teeth, some that went down whole, so many others that snapped and gnashed and sharded. And oh, the slicing of my throat. Oh, the sating, the fading, the calm. Then a tearing, twisting, writhing, and pain like I had known only once before. The mud of the cave on my skin, the darkness like I had not remembered darkness could be, a foul pile of bloody furs below me. I skittered, weak limbs. I whimpered, thin lips, small teeth. The girl came to me, above me, draped a blanket on me. There you are, Your Majesty, she looked strained. How do you feel? I felt so little. No rage, no fear, no hunger. I raised a claw to my face, but a hand touched my cheek instead. I barely knew how to use it. I remembered, fleeting as a dream, that I should not have done what I did. With fairies or beasts, I croaked, lips out of practice and throat hoarse. In palaces or pits, you must never eat what you crave or be enslaved to it forever. She adjusted the blanket on my shoulders. I don't know what nonsense they teach you up in that castle, she said. My mum says if you're sick and you're hungry for something, you probably need to eat some. Something else ached to me. Why? I said. She gently fitted the lid onto her sister's bones. I imagined she would bury my leavings. Why what? The curse. What was my sin? She shrugged. I didn't hear about any sin. Sometimes things just happen. She put her hand gently on the ossuary lid. When she looked at me, it was with kindness. I had forgotten. Hungry? I licked my lips. I lay still and listened to my whole body. My whole body. Sought my unfamiliar joints and skin for any longing, any pain. No, I said. My voice came out of my own mouth. I twitched my fingers in front of my eyes. Every inch of me was me. Every inch of me held together with human skin, human shape. Not an inch of me mired in craving, and every inch of me braced up by my own young bones.
My name is Keith Kennel, and I will be reading my story, Sacrifice for Selene. I awoke to the rhythmic beat, beat, beat inside my chest. Nary another sound I hear in our subterranean communal nest. I open my eyes, but there is no glow of fire. I sit up, grab my spear, and wonder what has transpired. I reached out tentatively with my hand in all directions. Only fur and moss, the things with which I connected. Alone in the dark, I inhale a small, sharp breath. Lying unawares and unprotected is an invitation to death. I take my spear and slowly extend it in a tentative, probing arc, ready to take on all comers who might attack me like frenzied sharks. Finding nothing amiss as I circle in protective stance, incrementally, I make my way through the dark cave towards dimmest glow at cave's entrance. My people have left me, disappeared into the night. What demon has captured them and taken them far from my sight? Pausing at the entree, I sniff the air and listen with all my ken, straining to learn what's happening, as on knowledge my life may now depend. Eyes can clearly see the glen illuminated by starlight. Slowly, it penetrates my mind that there's something wrong, as the moon should be full and bright. I creep slowly and with caution out of cave's embrace, keeping my back against the rock, silently cursing our missing sentinels who should be here protecting our flock. I blink my eyes and rub my face in an attempt to shed the veil. Where is the powerful moonlight that should enchantingly illuminate our trails? When to bed, I repose myself on the evening that was last. The moon was a shining ball of light which strong shadows cast. Selene cannot be coyly hiding behind the clouds in the sky, for thousands of pinprick stars are visible to my weary eyes. I scan the heavens in search of her, wondering where it is she's gone. My heart beating ever faster as I cannot spy her, beaming down upon us from her throne. Then I see her, and uncontrollably my mouth lets out a scream. Selene is covered in dark blood like a vision from darkened streams. What has happened to my goddess? Where have my people gone? My reality more frightening than any old crone's lamenting apocalyptic song. I stifle the scream in my throat that yearns to be expressed. Whoever has taken Selene hostage must be hiding near our nest. Knowing not for what I seek, all alone I begin my hunt. Feeling lost and alone, I venture out, wishing the usurper to confront. I force myself to slow the pace of heartbeat and advance. I know not what is lurking near as I hunt unknown minutes. Searching the ground for prints or spore, many tracks I do espy. I follow them carefully as dawn begins to grow nigh. In the clearing, I can see bodies lying all around, my clan and kinsmen lying lifeless without sound. I rush to them heedlessly, disregarding terrors of the dark, and fall upon my brother, whose life did not as yet depart. What has happened? I cry to him. Who has eradicated our folk? His glazed eyes on me slowly focus, and then with choking voice he spoke. We could not live in a world where Selene was not safely dancing in her sphere, so we killed ourselves in what we've done because we held our dear. With these words, his life is ended, and through my rain of tears, I see Selene has returned to the sky, and my vision of her is unobstructed and quite clear. Whatever demon held her in its evil embrace has been satiated and satisfied by the blood of my kinsman that he did taste.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.